This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe. Today's episode features a special hour-long interview with one of the all-time greats of South African cricket. He has over 400 test wickets to his name and has taken 26 five-wicket hauls on the biggest stage. And he's been a nightmare for international batsmen all over the world. My guest today is the great South African fast bowler, Dale Steyn.
Before we finish, stop recording and then we'll say save this video. So you've got it saved.
I really am going to get you a producer's fee, you know. All right.
Well, he's got him. That's just what South Africa wanted. It's a first test wicket for Dale Steyn. He's loving every moment of that.
Oh, knocked him over.
Great delivery here by Dale Steyn.
Straight through him, Dale Steyn continues to get wickets.
Well, he's got him, that's the end of the England innings. Dale Steyn makes the final breakthrough. Well, he's bowled at the stumps and he's hit off stump. Breakthrough for South Africa, top delivery by Dale Steyn.
Got him! Ends it with a beauty.
Well, Dale, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us here on the Cricket Collective. Before we get underway, I won't bother boring the listeners with the description of my study, but you're in a far, far more attractive part of the world, in Komaki, which is surfer's paradise. Just describe the view, what you're looking at now before we start the interview.
I'm quite fortunate that I have got a house on the beach in Komaki. So this morning I was sitting on the deck looking out at the ocean. Literally, I'm on the ocean. I walk out of the yard and walk 10, 15 meters and I'm on the sand, which is quite nice. But right now I'm in the backyard. I'm listening to the waves and I'm sitting here at the back on the veranda throwing the ball for my dog.
I think there's a lovely symbolism to your journey in life and your journey as a cricketer. Because you were born and raised in Palaboa, which is it's just like the sort of the epicenter of non-cricketing South Africa, and you've ended up with this amazing career. And you must have told the story 100 times, but how did you get from Palaboa to where you are?
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually. Just reading the list of things that you sent me on that email earlier, and just thinking, when did I do that stuff? That was like, how did that even happen? You know, yeah, it does make you think a little bit, but Yeah, I mean, I moved to Pretoria when I was about 20 and joined the Titans Cricket Academy. And then kind of from there, I was fortunate enough that it was roughly around the same time that the 2003 Cricket World Cup was happening. So I was bouncing around from being a net bowler to being a change room attendant, and then just got seen. And yeah, next thing you know, I was offered a Titans contract, and that's kind of where it kind of just took off.
There's a popular perception, certainly in England, that the moment you arrived on the international scene was that ball with which you bowled Michael Vaughan.
Oh, beautifully bowled! Dale Steyn has got exactly what he wants.
That was an absolute peach, wasn't it? Does that still a highlight for you?
Yes, I was on debut. I think it's probably going to go down as my second favourite wicket, because, the one that I'll always remember, I guess. One day when I'm sitting on my porch and I'm like 80 years old and someone says to me, can you remember any of your test wickets? I'll probably always remember that one, because it's the one that is most highlighted in my career. It's like, you know, it was, I think, my third wicket. But it just kind of set the scene for what's to come, what potential there is. You know, it's not like the previous wickets that were like, maybe caught at fine leg off a short ball or something like that. It was a genuinely great ball, you know. So, yeah, I kind of will be remembered, and I get reminded about it pretty much daily.
Yeah, and so you should. I mean, you know, there were a few series that I saw in which Muthiah Muralitharan, three test matches, you know, he took sort of 25 wickets. But the series against New Zealand in 2007, you know, there were only 40 wickets to take in the two test matches, and you took half of them, 20 wickets at nine, you know, 10 for 93 and 10 for 91. I know it wasn't a very strong New Zealand team, but I mean, did you feel like a one-man bowling attack?
Tough to kind of wrap my brain back around that period. It was so long ago. But one thing I do remember about that series was the first test was played at the Wanderers. And I remember the day before running in at training, I was with Vinnie Barnes and I was bowling to Pouch, and I was kind of all over the place. I wasn't really, in some regard, I was almost hitting side net. I wasn't quite nailing it. And I remember Pouch just walking out the net and walking up to me. And one of the best things about Pouch was that he was my keeper. So we played fetch or catch, not fetch. I'm thinking fetch with my dog. We played catch a lot, you know, and when I felt like I was going through a difficult period with the ball, he would run over to me and he'd always say to me, just get the ball through to me just a little bit. Let's just play catch a little bit. Let's just play catch. And I could slowly build like some confidence in getting the ball into the right area. And in that net the day before, he came over to me and he just said to me, look, I think you're running in with too much of an angle. And I think you need to straighten your run up, and it might just straighten up your lines a little bit. And I did it, and I think for like the next 5 or 10 minutes in that net, Pouch didn't lay bat on ball, and I probably cleaned him up a couple times. And whether it was him just working tricks, playing mind games with me and missing straight balls, I don't know. But I remember walking out the next day in the game and him coming over to me and just saying, just remember to run in a little bit straighter. And like, out of nowhere, the ball just came out like perfectly. The alignment was right, and I got the ball to talk. And when you're doing that in conditions that favor fast bowling at 140, 145 k's an hour, you're going to be pretty threatening, you know.
So that series, it pretty much clicked all the time. You know, there weren't particularly devastating spells. It looked like you could take a wicket virtually with every ball in every spell. But there were times when it did really, really click. And that, the 7 for 51 is your career best against India in Nagpur.
He's out. That's 7 wickets for Dale Steyn. India all out, 233. His best figures ever.
But what I remember about that is that India were going quite well. They were 192 for 3. And suddenly you bowled them out for 230. I mean, what is that? Is that the condition of the ball, or is it a rhythm thing? Because suddenly, you know, you went from hitting the middle of all their bats to just cleaning them up.
Yeah, well, I'm probably going to give away, people probably give me a lot more credit than I'm probably due, but, you know, I can remember two test matches, actually. One test match in Chennai where it was the first test in Chennai where Sehwag made 300. And I can remember also that I just couldn't pick up a wicket. I did everything I could and I could not pick up a wicket. And they changed the ball. Something happened to the ball, the seam had split or something. They changed the ball. And Graham gave me the ball straight away. And he was like, look, it's a changed ball, slightly harder. Let's see if you can do something. And I remember getting Dhoni out, bounced him. He gloved it, got caught. And then it just started to reverse a little bit. And I ended up picking up four in like 10 or 15 minutes. And pretty much the same thing happened in Nagpur. The game was kind of drifting away from us. India were in a good position. The new ball did do a little bit. I must be honest, it did swing a little bit that morning. It may have been a little bit overcast. I can't remember. But if you were going to have something out of that pitch, it was going to be with the brand new swinging ball. And I got Murali Vijay with one that the jag back in, pretty crafty kind of bowling. And I got Sachin with one that swung away and I nicked him off. Those are two good balls with a brand new cricket ball. But then they went through that like little phase where nothing was going on. They changed the ball. And I think it was like the second ball I ran in, this thing just ducked in big time. I didn't deliberately mean for it to happen. I don't think the batter knew it was going to happen. And he fell over and just clipped it straight to mid-wicket at Ashwell Prince Court. And once I saw that ball go, I knew, oh, I'm in with a chance. And then the next four wickets just happened like this. Bang, 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 bang. The ball was reversing. And when the ball's reversing like that, both ways, you can ask any batter. The best batsman in the world is going to struggle. So, yeah, got it in the right place. And I was able to pick up seven very, very quickly through a ball change. So sometimes it's not always the bowler, you know.
You know, one of my favorite days, when you retired from Test cricket, I remember telling this story about half a dozen times on the day that you announced your retirement. But it still makes me smile just saying the words 6 for 8. You took 6 for 8. That doesn't happen beyond under 11s.
Yeah, I was. I love that. That ball was like, I had it like on a string. It was just doing everything I wanted to. And actually, like the last ball of my spell, Misbah was batting and I got greedy and I was like, oh, I'm going to clean him up here. And my wrist just broke a little bit and it didn't swing as much. And he got like a glove that went down the leg side, very nearly caught by the keeper, but nowhere near the keeper, actually. It would have probably been like a leg slip, you know, would have been a catch. So, you know, had I not gotten greedy, I could have very easily ended up with 6 for 4.
It was swinging and so late. You know, it was like your classic delivery, but it was like a highlights package. Have you ever been more in control than you were that day?
If I ever want to get like just get a little bit of confidence, the thing for me, like I do a lot of my bowling comes from muscle memory, really. I've got a very clean and easy action, so I've never really struggled with that kind of stuff. Maybe every now and then just realign the direction in which I'm running in or where I'm landing on the crease. But for the most time, I'm living off just like past memories. And I often watch that spell just to try and get that feeling back of how easy it was, you know, because it just looks, when I watch it, it's like an out-of-body experience and you're able to watch and it just looks so easy and so in control. But I mean, that day was just from ball one, literally just came out the hand perfectly. And I really enjoy bowling at the Wanderers. It's one of my favorite places to bowl from the golf course end. It seems to always just be a little bit of something. Even when it's dead flat, there's always just out of nowhere, just something happens. So it's a great place to be a fast bowler.
Still to come on the Cricket Collective, find out why Dale Steyn quickly learnt not to annoy the captain of South Africa.
I ran him out his gloves, forgot his gum. They made me sit outside and watch the whole innings from like where the boundary rope was. It was freezing cold.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Bowden right through his defence. He's left that alone. So wicket now for Steyn as well.
Locked him over straight away. What a delivery. Dale Steyn is on a roll.
Got him!
Yeah, ripper! And deserves a 5-wicket bag to Dale Steyn. Another one bites the dust.
Now
take you back to your great mate Jacques Callis's last Test match against India again at Kingsmead. So India were 199 for two. They're batting first. You've drawn the first Test at the Wanderers. Famous draw, which I'm going to get you to talk about in a moment. We'll go back to that in a moment. But back, so here we are. It's a two Test series at Kingsmead. It's Jacques Callis's last Test match. India are 320 for five. You've struggled to take the first two wickets, and then suddenly, through what looked like sheer bloody-minded determination for Jacques, they've gone from 320 for five to 334 all out, and you've taken six for 100. I mean, that was just willpower, wasn't it? I mean, you were just willing everybody out.
You mentioned it, that the previous Test, I'd taken a bit of heat, actually, because there was two big things that happened in that Test match. Personally, for myself, was that I took the first wicket of that Test match. I got Shikhar Dhawan out with a short ball, caught fine leg. And then on what seemed to be like a good Wanderers track, we had moved around a little bit and everything like that, I never got another wicket for the rest of the Test match. I never got one, went past the bat a million times. India actually done some pretty good homework. They were leaving the ball really well on length. And if there was anything outside the eye line, they kind of just left it. And if it was on the stumps, they played it really well. So they had batted really nicely and worked us out quite nicely. And then the other thing that happened in that Test is that Faf and AB got us into a position where we could have won it. And myself and Vernon ended up needing to score a couple runs to win the Test, and decided that the best decision was to actually close up shop, and ended up needing like six runs or something stupid like that.
You were chasing 458, which would have smashed the world record. And then suddenly, was there an order? Was it your decision? Because there was Imran Tahir and an injured Mornay Morkel to come. So you could have actually lost the Test as well. You were seven down.
Yeah. So we didn't have much time. It was starting to get a little bit like dark, and the umpires were pressing us. Because now at this point, there's two guys out there that we're not known for our batting, although Vern can bat. And we needed to make a decision for the team. And I'm not calling for gloves. And the umpire's like, Brew, you can't call for gloves. You've only been here for 2 minutes, you know. And I'm trying to get some orders from the balcony into what we should do. So Vernon and myself decided that maybe the best thing to do was to kind of close up shop and not risk losing a Test match with only one Test match to go, and then having to draw a having to go to Durban winning that Test just to draw the series. So we decided that the best thing to do was to close up shop and draw that Test and go level into Durban and try and win in Durban to win the series. It was a tough decision too, because at the time, Dhoni, I think, was captain, and he had brought his quicks back on, and he had spread the field and got his quicks to bowl everything from waist to short bounces. And the only way to kind of score runs was to play the pool. Now, I'm batting at 9 and 10. I'm definitely not playing the pool as often as I'd like to. So I figured, well, if this is going to happen, chances are I'm probably going to get out, put Mornay in a position where he could get out, and Imi, and then lose the Test. So, yeah, so we went to Durban 0-0. And I had a pretty big point to prove when I got into Durban, because I'd taken some heat, you know, for not taking any wickets, and then deciding to close up shop instead of going for the win.
Callis is on 99. Two, and that's the 100. Fantastic innings, Jack Callis.
And then Jacques scores 100. I mean, how good was Jacques Callis? How good must you be to score 100 in your last Test match? You went on, of course, to win the Test, and it was a perfect send off for Jacques. But staggering, isn't he? What, is he the greatest cricketer you've played with?
He's by far the greatest cricketer I've ever played with. He can catch anything. He bowls. He scores hundreds. You can't find a more complete cricketer than Jacques Callis. You know, he's just—he doesn't moan. You know, he just kind of stands there, sits there in his spot in the dressing room, offers great assistance and words of advice when needed. And then whatever the captain decides, he goes with it, with a strong mindset. And he's the ultimate professional. You know, he'd get out first ball, and he'd walk back to where he sits. He'd sit down, take his bat and his gloves or whatever, and he'd just start cleaning his bat again, fixing his shoes, Whereas some of us would walk in there, throw our stuff all over the place, you know, and go wild. He was the perfect professional. Probably my favorite cricketer.
The highs not too high and the lows not too low. It's a bit of a role model for life, really, isn't it? He wasn't a great overreactor.
No, he didn't get too excited. Although I did see him once. I remember we were playing against the West Indies in Cape Town, and one of the bowlers was giving him some heat when he was batting. I can't remember who it was. One of the West Indian quicks, and Woogie came on bowl, and he cranked it up. It's the fastest I've ever seen him bowl, and he got a little lippy there too because he was backed by a heavy ball. One of the few times I've seen some emotion come out of Jock. But for the most part, you know, just this kind of silent warrior, you know.
We're going to talk about 2008 in a moment, those 6 months, you know, when you went to England and won that series and then went to Australia and became the first South African team ever to win a test series in Australia. But before we go there, I want to ask you, what's the best wicketless spell you ever bowled?
Test matches, there's been a couple. I think I bowled one session to Sachin where I'm almost certain I nicked him off and the umpire gave it not out, and we hardly gave any kind of an appeal in Cape Town, and he managed to bat through and score a pretty big knock. And then another one in Cape Town against England, I bowled to Ian Bell, I think, and was it Collingwood? Maybe Collingwood. Jeez, they just closed up shop. Couldn't get them out. I felt like if we got a wicket there, we would have run through them, especially it was the second new ball. And then Graham Onions, Bunny Onions, came in to bat at number 11 and blocked out. And it was just a famous draw. That was a spell where I probably bowled beautifully and just didn't pick up a wicket. And, you know, and another player that I've bowled well to as an opening batter is Rohit Sharma. Whether it be 2020 or one day cricket, I bowled beautifully to him and just haven't managed to get him out either. I think he's played and missed at about 80% of the balls that I've ever bowled to him and still hasn't nicked one. So it's not like he's caned me all over the ground or anything like that. I just haven't been able to get him out.
You mentioned Ian Bell there. Of course, he scored 199 in that first test of the 2008 series at Lord's. And that was a famous draw as well with the top three, Graham Smith, Neil McKenzie and Hashim Amla, all scoring hundreds. And then... You won at Headingley by 10 wickets after A.V. de Villiers scored 170 and Ashwell Prince also scored 100. And so you went to Edgbaston. And, of course, you were 12th man because you'd broken a finger, I recall. I don't remember where because you played in the first two test matches. But that win at Edgbaston when Graham Smith made the unbeaten 154, that still gives me goosebumps. The occasion, Yeah, obviously gives you goosebumps as well. You're shaking your head.
Oh, amazing. Never seen somebody more in the zone. People talk about the zone, and I've felt it before. I've felt like I've been there, you know, and I don't quite know, like, what it looks like when I'm in the zone, like, you know, whether I'm talking to anybody or whatever it was. But that was a day that I was able to see somebody actually, like, be in the zone. And Graham, as a leader, he'd walk into the dressing room and we would all kind of like gather around him and be like, well, what's the plan? You know, what are we doing? And he was just so calm. He was so relaxed. It was like he was on drugs or something like that. You know, he was just like, he didn't look himself. You know, he was just super chilled, super relaxed, and he kept everyone so calm. And especially at a ground like Edgbaston where the old dressing rooms used to be under the like pavilion. So it sounded like you could just hear the people like banging above your head like this. And when Flintoff was running in and bowling those Yorkers where the guys couldn't see it out of the side screen, I was 12th man and I was myself. It was just the like craziest noise you've ever heard. And probably as close as it would come to feeling like you were playing in an Ashes. And you know, English crowd, they can get loud, especially when they're on. And Graham was just able to kind of like just completely put the blinds on and not hear it and not see it and just batted like he was playing at schoolboy level, you know.
You know, chewing gum to to Graham was, you know, his gum was like kryptonite was to Superman. And he called for new gloves during that 154. I think it was just after he got to 100, you know, when the tension was at its greatest. And new gloves meant new gloves, but also fresh gum. And you not being a very good 12th man, because you didn't do it very often, you forgot his gum, didn't you, at one point?
I did. I ran him out his gloves, forgot his gum, got, I think he popped out of his zone there for a second, gave me the death stare, realized quickly what I needed to fix, bolted off. And my punishment, because I was 12th man with, I can't remember who else was 12th man, but they made me sit outside and watch the whole innings from like where the boundary rope was. It was freezing cold. And I was sitting there and I was just watching this guy bat. And if he so much as just blinked in my direction, I stood up waving my hand like, what do you need? What is it that I can get you? So yeah, not the world's best 12th man. And you learn that lesson once, you know, especially when it's the captain of the South African cricket.
Is that one of or the best test innings that you saw?
Hash's 300 was something special.
Well, it's 303. Ashim Amla, well played. Enjoy this moment.
There's been some phenomenal hundreds. JP's 100 at MCG. AB made one or two hundreds against India. Got a massive hit, the biggest six I've ever seen in my life. He hit Harbhajan so far. It was massive. Then he scored another big 100.
Is that his 100? Yes, it is. What a 100 from AB de Villiers.
And I think he could have made 300 that day in Abu Dhabi. But being the team man that he was like, I think once he had broken the South African record, I think it was it him or someone? He got close. He was like, that's it, guys. We need to bowl these guys out. I'm out of here. So, you know, it just showed what a good team man he was too. But wow, our guys have scored some good hundreds. Hash scoring 100 with, was it Graham and Avey in Perth?
97 to de Villiers. He goes again. Does he get it away? He's got at least three. It'll be a boundary and a test match 100.
Yeah, they scored it like 10 and over for a session. I mean, the guys just didn't know where to bolt to them. And they made it look so easy. They were just running the ball down the third man, and then they would put a third man in, and then he'd walk across and then flick him down. It looked like he was playing one-day cricket. You know, it was just with a red ball.
Still to come on the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2, Dale Steyn reveals why he regrets missing out on scoring a test century.
When I got out, I thought, I was four hits away from 100. And I'm like, I could back myself to hit that guy for 4 sixes. What was I doing? Why was I blocking it?
This is the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with the Institute of Cricket.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Gone for Duck. That's another big wicket for Steyn. Gone. 10 wickets for
Dalstein, what a performance on the MCG.
Gets it through. Will this be the three? That will do it. What a thunderous victory that is for South Africa. And South Africa have chased down 4-1-4.
We went to Australia, so a dozen South African teams had been going to Australia for a century. None of them had won a series. And then you chased down 414 in the first test match in Perth. 414. And you win before lunch on the fifth day. You have to say it again, don't you? Australia made 394. South Africa were 184 for seven. And you win the test match. And you put on 180 for the ninth wicket with JP Dimini. I mean, it's just, you can't make that stuff up.
Yeah, it's been years, and it seems like it's still something that a lot of people take a lot of joy out of. And a lot of people tell me that they turned the TV on and they saw us at 180 for seven, and then they were like, oh, no, we won the first one. We're going to lose the second, and then hopefully we can win the third, you know. And they turned the TV off, and then they turned the TV back on, and then we were 300 or 400 for seven, and they were like, oh, South Africa, they had to bat a second time, you know? And it's like, oh, no, we're actually still batting. Like, it's still the first innings. So, just a great test match.
What are the memories that make you laugh? Because, I mean, Bouch tells me he so seven down, he starts taping his fingers to get ready to go out and keep. And he had his fingers taped for about a day and a half. And Jacques used to love it being in his shorts for as long as possible, didn't he? He put his whites on. So he had his whites on for a day and a half. I mean, there must have been times where you and JP batted through almost a day. There must have been times like at tea when you walked off and you were still together. You probably just laughed at each other, didn't you?
We were. I mean, we were just when we batted for a session, like for an hour, I was blown away. Like I was like, wow, we just batted for an hour together. You know, I don't know if we scored many runs in that hour, maybe 30 or 40 runs or whatever it was. And then I'd stand there and I said to him, I've never batted for an hour in a test match. And we would just laugh, you know, and we would just laugh and we'd get our drink and really enjoy like that, the atmosphere and the space of the MCG, because it's just sort of, it's one of my favorite places to play cricket. It's a massive coliseum, packed house, 120,000 people or whatever it was. And you just stand there and you just look around and you feel like you're a gladiator, you know. And then we'd bat for another hour, and then we'd have another drinks break, or it would be tea or lunch or whatever it is. And we'd be walking off the field and we just look at each other and we're like, what just happened? Like, how did that even happen? You know, like give each other like a fist of the gloves, and then we would go into lunch. And walking into the dressing room the first time, everyone was very excited, clapping, well done, boys. And then the superstition started to click in. Guys are not allowed to move in their seats. When we batted for another hour and we walked in the tea, it was like dead quiet. It was like guys would come over and they'd like pat you on the back. They're like, well done, guys, just keep going. Because now they didn't want to break this voodoo that had just like kind of like come into the game. And then get up in absolute silence with JP and walk back out into that Coliseum and then just carry on, you know. But then when JP got his 100, then you just saw everyone down, like, on the fence. They were all going wild. I still have visions of it, like, whenever Supersport play it on TV. And then when you look again, they were gone. Poof, they were gone. They were back into the dressing room, wherever they were, like, sitting on their same seats or something like that. So, you know, those things make me laugh.
The joy of the unfamiliar is never better illustrated by the fact that you're 76 in that innings. It completely overshadows the fact that you actually took 10 wickets to win the test match. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I've been asked many times before, would I rather have taken 10 in the game or would I rather have scored 100? And I can guarantee you I've taken 10 wickets in many games before, but I would have loved to have scored 100. And Andrew Simons was actually bowling, and he was like looping these like little soft offies up to me, trying to entice me to, you know, go for a big shot and try and hit him out of the ground and get caught somewhere. And I can remember just leaning forward and just blocking and thinking to myself, not today.
I'm not falling for that trick. I'm not letting my bowler brain take over. And I just blocked. And when I got out, I thought, I was 4 hits away from 100. And I'm like, I could back myself to hit that guy for 4 sixes. What was I doing? Why was I blocking it? But yeah, like, great, like, knock with JP. But yeah, I mean, my main job was to take wickets. And I was lucky that I got 10 in that game.
I come back to your batting. And this wasn't too long ago, actually. But you're playing a one-day international against Zimbabwe in Bloemfontein. And you walk out with South Africa at 101 for 7. I mean, that's deep trouble. That was against Zimbabwe. And you end up winning the game by 120 runs. You made 60. But you could have done more consistently with the bat if you'd taken it. I don't know, if you'd thought like a batsman, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, like in school, I did both. I batted and I bowled. And funny enough, when I finished high school and I went into my first academy year, I had a bad hamstring injury. So for the better half of the year, I wasn't bowling and I was batting. So I opened the batting because it just seemed like I wanted to be involved. And I ended up getting batsman of the year in that academy year in 2002 and didn't bowl much. But then once I gone over to the Titans, I put all my effort into bowling. I wanted to play for the Titans and I wanted to play for South Africa. And I felt like if there was a chance for me to get into these teams, I needed to put 100% of that effort into bowling. That's how I was going to make these teams. And then once I started playing for South Africa more regularly and working with guys like Duncan Fletcher, having some of the best batters in the world with Callis, Hash, and AB, just spending some time with them, the batting slowly started to improve. And at one stage, I was even South Africa's night watchman for probably 2 or 3 years. Because that knock in 2008, I was batting behind Paul Harris and Mornay Morkel, which is probably the worst. I don't know how that ever happened. Like, that's... So, yeah, you know, so that knock against Zimbabwe, I even said it in the press conference afterwards that I'd been playing for almost 13 or 14 years of international cricket. I can't believe that I had to wait that long to score my first one-day 50.
Edged. There it is. South Africa have won. They've won this match. They've won the series. And they go to the top of the world rankings.
2012 then, Dale. You go back to England and... The first test at the Oval is an absolute epic. It'll always be remembered for Jacques Callis and Hashim Amla batting for, 3.5 days or whatever it was. But England, but they batted first, and they're 270 for 3 overnight or after the first day, and it's looking pretty bleak on a flat pitch. But you know, you bounce back the next day, bowled them out. Sometime after lunch, South Africa make 637 for 2. As you said, Hashim Amla's 311 not out. But 637 for 2, that's the longest you ever had off, isn't it, in a test match?
Well, I was night watchman in that game. And, I mean, I was myself because I'm a tail ender. So anytime I have to go in and bat, I'm always going to be, you know, a little bit worried and everything like that. I was night watchman. I had to pad up 4 times or something to go and bat, and I never batted. So I padded up more than AB and some of the other guys in that test match, and I never batted. But I mean, those guys were amazing, you know. And after the day one, we were staring down the barrel a little bit and had spoken about it overnight. Gary had pulled the guys in. And he said, not to worry, guys, you know, we just need to look at where we went wrong. And we felt that our bowling is probably a bit wide. We didn't attack the stumps enough. And then the next morning, straight away, we just tightened up the line a little bit. We probably bowled 3 or 4 overs where there wasn't any runs. And then I got Alistair Cook to drag one on.
Bowling, inside edge, great bowling. Great plans from South Africa.
When he went for one that was slightly wider, he didn't take full advantage. Dragged it onto the poles, and then we just started a flurry where we were able to bowl them out and then bat and bat big.
You won by an innings and 12 runs, but that, I mean, that sounds like a thrashing, but there was only an hour to go, as I recall. I mean, it was deep into the fifth day. you took five, and I remember you turning around to, I don't know whether it was somebody in the press box or some, or somebody in a commentary box.
All gone. The last over, Swan drove one in the air, but to the cover boundary. This time he's found the man, and that is five for Dale Steyn.
You were quite animated, you know. You held up the big fifer, and you were. It looked like. Were you? Did you have a point to prove to somebody?
I can't remember. I mean, I know that I was probably going in the direction of somebody that had written or said something about me. I can't remember. I mean, you know what it is. Sometimes the English press can be quite hard. Anybody that's ever played any sport in England or anything will know that. And it's all part of it, really. It's all part of sometimes getting the best out of players and sometimes just seeing whether they can actually handle it or not. And I remember just taking five and something in me just said, it was one of the very few times that I've actually turned towards like the press or somebody or something like that and almost shown them off in a way. But yeah, I was quite excited that I was able to, and I think it may have been because playing against England was probably my bogey team. I never did as well against England as I would like to have done versus maybe all the other teams. I think if you look at, I'm not a big stats person, but it was pointed out to me that my stats against England were probably nowhere near as good as what it was against other teams. So that may have like been a spark where I was like, well, I can play against these guys.
Yeah, your test wickets cost 30 against England, and that's a little higher than your career average, but it's not. It doesn't suggest that you got spanked all around the ground. However, one time you did get spanked was in the next test match. So you win the first test in 2012 at the Oval. The second one's at Headingley, where Kevin Peterson rates that 100, his 100, and particularly the way he played you as one of the best moments in his career.
Oh, my goodness me. I cannot tell you how good a bowler Steyn is. And that's as dismissive, even more violently dismissive, than the last shot he hit to the boundary. I mean, he just played him as if he was a little off-spinner.
Yeah, no, he was, I mean, it was next level. It was like he was batting to prove a point, and I'm almost certain he was trying to prove some point. I mean, KP plays without a lot of fear. He's really plays this fearless kind of cricket. And I think in that test match, there'd been a lot happening. So yeah, there was that sense that he probably was sitting there thinking to himself, well, I'm just going to take it to these guys. And when you've got the amount of talent that somebody like KP has got and the strong mindset that he's got, he can really do anything. And then the ball was hooping around. It was swinging around a little bit. And even Graham came to me with a second new ball and he was like, okay, cool, bud. Listen, I want you to go through about four or five overs. Yeah, let's try and knock over one or two poles. I really need you to strike. And I think I bowled the second ball with that new ball and KP ran at me and just smashed me over my head for six. I bowled two overs, went for 20, maybe 22 or 23. And he came to me and said, okay, cool, I'm going to bring the spinner on. I'm sorry, you're out of the attack. And I was like, that's fine. This guy is playing me like I'm no one. So yeah, one of the better knocks that I've seen him play. He was amazing.
So you draw the test match, you go to Lord's for the third and final test match with the world number one ranking at stake. That was a terrific test match, wasn't it? Really close in the end. You won by 54 runs, but it felt closer than that. And you became world number one, and it was tinged with sadness, wasn't it? Because Mark Boucher was sitting at home with only one eye at that stage.
Yeah, well, we had the best build-up to a test series that I've ever had. We went to Switzerland with Mike Horn. Paddy Upton and Gary Kirsten had masterminded this pre-series kind of trip for the boys. And when asked, are you taking your cricket kit with? And we were like, no. And it was like, are you going to be doing any bowling? No. Are you going to be doing any batting there? No. What are you doing in Switzerland? You know, like, are you going on holiday to Switzerland? And it was like, no, we're not going on holiday to Switzerland. But we went to Switzerland without any cricket kit. And we went on this kind of mental toughness couple days with Mike Horn. And I remember the leader of that whole kind of thing was Bouch. He really wanted to prove a point And he was in the front when we went for these runs. He was in the front row when we had these talks. He was right in there, right next to Mike, listening. And he was super like amped for that series, you know, and especially later that year going to Australia. So he was really pumped for that. And then in a warm-up match to lose his eye was just like, you know, it was kind of maybe exactly what needed to happen for him to prepare for that losing his eye. You know, had he not gone to Switzerland, I don't know if he would have dealt with losing his eye any better. So it was probably a good thing that we went to Switzerland for his sake. But yeah, you know, not to get sidetracked, but that game was amazing to go and win the game. And some of the better memories are of Graham and Jock running around Lords and writing on their shirts, you know, "This one's for you, Butch." It just felt like that series we were playing for him throughout that whole series. So it was really important.
Still to come on this week's Cricket Collective, hear why Dale Steyn is looking forward to finishing his cricketing career.
I think that there's so much more that I've missed out on in terms of life whilst I was playing cricket. I've been to India 26 times and I've never been to the Taj Mahal.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Something special here, so special. Look at this. Oh my goodness. How do you play that?
Changing tack, you've had three spells in county cricket, beginning with Essex when you were a very young man, and more recently with Hampshire, Warwickshire in between. What do you make of county cricket? Is it as relentless as people say?
You know, I've always loved playing county cricket, and it doesn't really matter which team you play for. I can't pick a favorite team. They all played a part in my career as I was going. When I first played for Essex, I was very, very young, knew nothing about cricket. I had played a handful of international cricket, and I was kind of just figuring out what touring life was like. It was one of the first times I'd been to England. The next time when I went to Warwickshire, I was a little bit more of a finished kind of article of a player. I had some cricket behind me, and I was able to be one of the more leaders in that Warwickshire attack. And by the time I hit Hampshire, you know, I was a full-time professional, been doing this for 15 years kind of player. And everyone around that team, they've seen players come and go. They've had some of the best at Hampshire, from Shane Warne to, you know, Neil McKenzie to Gordon Grinch, Barry Richards. So they've seen the pros come, you know. And for me at that point was just to come in and blend in with them, you know, and figure out what they wanted to do, how they want to run their cricket. And I've just got to kind of blend in. So I've always enjoyed playing county cricket. They look after you so well. They love eat, sleep, drink cricket. If you're a young cricketer and you can get over, I mean, I would definitely recommend it.
I remember asking Hashim Amla a few years ago whether he regarded himself as a role model for not just young South African Asian Indians, but, you know, just a role model for young cricketers. And he said, cricketers are role models. You have no choice. Your only choice is whether you're a good role model or a bad role model. And it's this kind of responsibility that's thrust upon you sometimes. I suppose it must be inconvenient rather than something that you resent, because you're a free-spirited guy.
I think sometimes you can't control what people think of you or how people react to what you do. So it's what I've learned in the last 15 years or whatever is not to get too caught up on the smaller things. And I see young players these days, you know, they'll come into the dressing room. They're like, "Oh, this one guy was abusing me on Twitter." And I'm like, "Well, what about the 80,000 other people that are saying the great things about you? You know, you're going to really worry about that one person, you know?" And it takes a couple of years to kind of get to that point. But, you know, through social media, I think the one thing that, like, I've certainly tried to do is just to kind of bridge the gap between what people think you are when they watch you on a cricket field to who you really are, and then give them an opportunity to kind of make up their minds whether they actually who they want to support. You know, whether they want to support the cricketer that they watch, or whether they want to support the person that they're starting to get to know on a more personal level. But there's one thing that Hash is right about, is that you can't get away from it. It doesn't matter where you go, you have that responsibility, you know, of being a role model. So even in lockdown now, it doesn't matter what I do, you got to do the right thing, otherwise someone's going to have a go at you, you know. But it's fine. I've gotten so used to it now, so it's okay.
We're coming towards the end of the program, but I must ask you about the IPL. I know you've loved it. The chaos is something that you seem to embrace, whereas other people can get frustrated by the chaos of India. That's something that you appear to find a positive energy in. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've always kind of haven't really let that part of my life affect me too much. I've always kind of felt like I'm on the same level as everybody else. Although I play cricket at the highest level, you know, I'm still only human. I'm just like anybody else, you know. So, and I try not to let the craziness of the crowd all cheering for you, like, get too ahead of above myself, really. But I do enjoy going there. There's no better feeling than playing in front of, you know, 80,000 people at Wankhede or at RCB, you know. It's just amazing. It can get the best out of you when you've got the ball in your hand. It just gets the energy going and those competitive juices really flying.
You've had a long and successful and obviously lucrative career as well. And I know that I asked you once before, do you have any indulgences? And I think the biggest indulgence is that you bought your mother a new house and your father a new Harley Davidson. For you, it just seems to be about, you know, having a nice surfboard and playing with your dogs. I mean, do you have any sort of indulgences? Do you treat yourself?
So I love going on surfing trips and fishing trips. The further it seems like the further and deeper and more hidden away that you try and go on these trips, the more expensive they actually are. You know, going to Bolivia in the middle of the Amazon jungle, or trying to get away to some sneaky island off Indonesia to go like surfing, you would think it should be cheap, but they prove to be quite expensive. So that's kind of where I've kind of been spending my money, but that's fine. You know, like, I would rather like die having lived those experiences than putting money into some stupid thing like a car or something silly like that, you know.
I don't want to get too existential just to finish off with, but you've achieved so much as a cricketer. I just get the sense that you actually think that life is just beginning.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very excited about cricket coming to an end, actually. I think that there's so much more that I've missed out on in terms of life whilst I was playing cricket. And that was my period. You know, I played cricket and I'm still playing right now, but there's so much more to see and so much more to do. I've been to India 26 times and I've never been to the Taj Mahal. I've had friends that have come over to India to come and watch me play cricket, and they've done more in India than I've done in the 26 times that I've been there. And I spend a minimum of like 3 to 4 weeks every time I go, you know. And I've been to Australia, but I've never been to the Great Barrier Reef. You know, it's these kinds of things that I really want to experience. And I think I've ticked the cricket box, but there's these other things that I kind of want to really do right now. And if I can blend them with my cricket whilst I'm still playing, even better, you know, that would be even better. So I'm trying to do that right now. Like, I'm trying to get the most out of my cricket, but the most out of my experiences when I'm out and about and everything like that. But I know once cricket finishes, I'll have more time to kind of do that stuff. Take friends and family along so that they can experience those things with me, rather than me coming around the fire pit and telling them these stories of where I've been and what I've experienced. I'd rather have us sit there and talk about something that we've all done together. That would be pretty cool.
Dale Steyn, thank you so much indeed for your time. I hope you get onto the beach soon, and you presumably have managed to maintain your fitness while you've been locked down. Have you got a little gym at home, have you?
Manners, you won't believe it, but on day 3 of lockdown,
I was sweeping the house, doing domestic work, something I haven't done since I was in boarding school. And I seemed to have hurt my lower back, like slipped a disc or something in my lower back. And I haven't been able to do any kind of strength and conditioning work in the last 3 weeks. But yeah, to be honest with you, I've done nothing.
Enjoy the rest of lockdown. And once again, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure.
My thanks to Dale Steyn for the last hour as we recall some of the highs and lows of his illustrious career. If you missed any of the show or wish to catch up, then download the Following On podcast from Apple Podcasts, Acast, or Spotify. And thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.